Hey everybody, how are you doing?
Excellent.
Welcome to the Scott House and to this reading by acclaimed poet and world famous speaker, filmmaker, etc. Jimmy Santiago Baca. My name is Liz Canfield, professor in the Department of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies here at VCU. I co-direct the Open Minds program with Dave Coogan, and I'm also the founding co-director of Sanctuary, which is a re-entry space for people once they get out of jail or prison.
And this event is co-sponsored by Sanctuary, by the Humanities Research Center at VCU, and the University's Division for Community Engagement, to all of whom many thanks. My name is Richard Godbeer. I'm the director of the Humanities Center and also a professor in the History Department.
Jimmy Santiago Baca is the author of over a dozen books of poetry, in addition to numerous published memoirs, essays, and stories. Baca's work is concerned with social justice and revolves around the marginalized and disenfranchised, treating themes of addiction, community, injustice, and the American Southwest. His volumes of poetry include Immigrants in Our Own Land, Martin and Meditations on the South Valley, Sea Train and 13 Mexicans, A Glass of Water, Working in the Dark, Adolescence on the Edge, see what I'm saying about numerous books, Stories from the Edge, Winter Poems Along the Rio Grande, Spring Poems Along the Rio Grande, Black Mesa Poems, The Importance of a Piece of Paper, and Healing Earthquakes.
Baca is the winner of the Pushcart Prize, the American Book Award, the Hispanic Heritage Award in Literature, and for his memoir, A Place to Stand, the prestigious International Prize. In 2006, he won the Cornelius P. Turner Award, which recognizes one GED graduate each year who has made outstanding contributions to society in education, justice, health, public service, and social welfare. A decade ago, he created Cedar Tree, a non-profit foundation that works to give people from all walks of life the opportunity to become educated and improve their lives. He's conducted hundreds of writing workshops in prisons, community centers, libraries, and universities throughout the country.
Born in New Mexico and identifying as Chicano, Jimmy Santiago Baca was raised first by his grandmother and later sent to an orphanage. A runaway at age 13, it was after Baca was sentenced to 5 years in a maximum security prison that he learned to read and write and unearthed a voracious passion for poetry. He emerged from prison a writer and sent three of his poems to Denise Levertov, the poetry editor of Mother Jones. The poems were published and later became part of Immigrants in Our Own Land, published in 1979, which, by the way, is for sale back there, along with numerous other books that I mentioned earlier. This book, Immigrants in Our Own Land, was published in 1979, the year that he was released from prison. He earned his GED later that year, that same year, and the rest, as they say, is history.
So please join us in welcoming Jimmy Santiago Baca.
I wanted to introduce a friend of mine. I have two people read. One of them is Joe. I recently visited Reed Army Hospital, where I do workshops with some of the vets. I go about once a year there. And Joe is one of the exemplary poets from there, and he's going to read. And then after him, a great man there, standing there. Go ahead and wave. That's Perry. And Perry's an extraordinary man in his own right. So Joe's going to read a poem, and then Perry, then I'll read.
Thank you, Jimmy, and thank you, everybody, for coming out. It's an honor to be here and to read along with Jimmy. Like he said, he comes out and does workshops with veterans, and the goal of these workshops is to bring writing and art to be able to overcome moral injuries or whatever might have come about due to military experience from combat or non-combat. This is a poem that I wrote called Candy. When we met at the airport, exchanging names like politicians and prostitutes, you are not my first. I certainly won't be your last. Generic titles for short interactions. I didn't care what you called me, but you held the taste of sweet revenge I had long dreamed of. I called you candy. Like cheap, chalky confection wrapped in clear cellophane, hot breath wrapped around me, unwanted embraces until I scarred the bosom of your earth. Then came frozen tears spilled down the mountains of your face. In the past, you only washed away remnants of sheep that ate from the crevice of your palm. Now your hand reeks of fuel stained by depleted uranium. John's wage war across the desolation of your navel, explosion, pocked veins, you didn't ask for this. When we met, you were not my mother. Now who I am is born from you. Thank you, Afghanistan.
I'm Perry Gedurgis. I'm with a company called Resiliency Arts. I'm developing several films over the last couple of years, and one of them is with Jimmy. It's called 100 Less Court Dates and a Wake-Up, stories about successful reentry. Working with some other guys like Jimmy who have been formerly incarcerated as myself, who've gone on to really touch other people's lives and in a sense paying it forward by the people that have helped them, male or female, this transformation and redemption that a lot of us experience. So I actually filmed at the New Mexico Maine Penitentiary. They had a riot there in 1980, and 33 inmates were killed, murdered, and there's one book called The Devil's Butcher Shop. I was working with T.J. Purcell, who's written a book about sexual violence and his experience with that in prison in the 1970s. And I sat in that guest chamber, and it occurred to me, and they even were shooting video while I was sitting there talking, that it reminded me also of iron lungs. And younger people probably don't maybe know what iron lungs are, people that have polio. So, and here's a glossy one. That, you know, just did some Google, found these pictures. So here's what I wrote. Dull and shiny with forbidden locks it goes, stare at tight latches and bolted nuts beating, frozen in time with fright and fight inside of flesh. Imaged bleeding air, you gas the hole, cold gasping and stark moving stillness, confined for time that's hissing everything and nothing. Repeating iron encasements held strongly together. A time-traveling machine you can consider with straps. Unreadable gauges near trapped hoses and knobs. Big, smooth wheels make electricity painfully real. Fast, heavy steel that holds itself for too long. Exhale, grab empty air, not letting you move. Hot and sweaty with floating burst of stinky odors. Excel your barely held need for God. Look into the glass windows and avoid reflections. Hugged by loving irons and vapors and coughs. Forcefully trust and not a damn thing you can do about it. Hold on for more pain with your lost dreams and hopes. Possibilities held on and barely held up by clammy skin. Smoky wind mirrors and pills and not much more. Cry and say, forgive me not. Humming vapor vacuum motors keep running unbroken. Waiting for burst of air and breath that's not there yet. Last strains to hold on or hold out or be leaky. Stung by the drips of damp and poison air that's not spoken. Distant clocks can't tell. Unplug time or space. Pressure you can't measure or float in these glass ponds. Encase without fear and you're a goner, for sure a goner. And you can't yell what crimes. So weak and worn out lips can't speak the echoes, that hopeful cracked lips that close and drop you from harm. Whispers are unheard and empty, unannounced hellos. What lurks behind these steely, shiny metal capsules? Into brick hallways without a group marching, bugs fly while holding dead life outside. So hearts blocking the straining throats with their purple bulges. Sun burns don't matter because the sun is dark. Having cared and comfort in round, empty corners, it's time to suffocate and not hurt others or me anymore. Instruments take and produce unwavered goodbyes, and metal air has gone homeless without you anymore. One supports and one destroys measures of life. Thank you, polio and gas, for another time in travel. So it's a work in progress.
Both these guys are working in movements that have taken on national acclaim now. Perry's working with addiction. Are any of you going to D.C. for that big addiction march on, when is it?
This Sunday, Unite to Face Addiction.
Sunday? About 50 you're going. I know she's going. There's about 70,000 people coming, maybe more. Are y'all going to go? Has anybody ever taken drugs in this room? Okay. All the professors raise their hands. I guess you have to deal with your students, right? But anyway, no, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. I got a main line it this morning. I got a rough class or whatever, you know. Joe is working. He's a serviceman, and he's had the courage to break out of the rank and file and think on his own. And he's working on some poems and stuff. And they're both they both are people I admire greatly. I'm going to read you a poem, one from each book, and then something from this new novel. This one's called "What Is Broken Is What God Blesses." The lover's footprint in the sand, the 10-year-old kid's bare feet in the mud picking chili for rich growers. Not those seeking cultural or ethnic roots, but those whose roots have been exposed and hacked and dug up and burned. And in those roots do animals burrow for warmth. What is broken is blessed. Not the knowledge and empty shell, the wisdom paraphrased from textbooks, and not the mimicking nor plaques of distinctions, nor the ribbons and medals, but after the privileged carriage has passed, breeze blows, traces of wheel ruts away, and on the dust will again be the people's broken footprints. What is broken, God blesses. Not the perfectly brick-on-brick prison, but the shattered wall that announces freedom, proclaims the irascible spirit of the human rebelling against betrayal, against taking what's not deserved. The human complaint is what God blesses. Our impoverished dirt roads filled with cripples coming back from war. What is broken, the irreverent disbeliever, the addict's arm seamed with marks as a thread line of a blanket frayed from keeping the man warm. And we are all broken ornaments, glinting in our worn-out gloves, foreclosed homes, ruined marriages, broken dreams, from which shimmer our lives in their deepest truths. Blood from the wound is nothing but a broken ornament. When we lost our perfection and honored our imperfection, we were blessed. Broken are the ghettos and the barrios and the trailer parks where white gangs duel to death, and yet through the wretchedness, here comes a woman of 60 riding her bicycle. We embrace, we bury in our hearts a memory of that woman. We bury in our hearts broken ornaments, accused and hunted, finding solace. We work, we worry, we love, but always reflecting our blessings and our brokenness thrives the essence of our strength. Each of us is a warm fragment of what's been broken, broken off from the greater ornament of the unseen, then rejoined as dust to all that is in the universe. And does anybody take physics here? Well, that poem has its basis in physics. As you all know, that we're all joined to everything that is, right? Simple stuff, right? The Buddhists knew that thousands of years ago, before the idiots at Los Alamos started figuring it out under microscopes. But I do respect science. No, I do. I mean, they came up with LSD. Right? They came up with higher potency in marijuana. For all the wrong reasons, do I love science? I'm kidding you. I'm just going to read you a very small portion of this, okay? Since I am in Richmond, and was it Grant that was besieged by, was it Lee besieged by Grant here, right? Mm-hmm. Is that true? Yeah, it was, right? Yeah, that's all I've been thinking about tonight is how Lee survived the being besieged by Grant, and where these houses were and what they ate and all of that stuff. He should have called some Mexicans. We're good at getting stuff in and out when people don't want us to. You know? Hello, is this Pancho Villa? Yeah. We need some food, carnal. Orale, ahí voy. And we would have come dressed as ostriches or something. I don't know. Celebrate how Europeans stepped off every woodland, sea line, mountain ridge, and valley line, and fenced them as their own. Celebrate how los indios waved the children in their arms and how the captain shot them. Celebrate the treaty of peace Europeans signed, only to rise at midnight and slaughter the sleeping. Celebrate how pioneers stripped 1,000-year-old forests to build Philadelphia and Boston and Richmond, and how they excluded Indios from fishing the streams, and how water flowed in slave plantations and fields of the wealthy. Let us celebrate how Columbus wondered at the clean waters and the air and fowl and animals their hunger would feast on. Celebrate the land subdivided for exclusive estates and fancy homes, and how millions of human beings came landless and infected and were slaughtered. How centuries of deep coexistence with Mother Earth was scoffed at and smudged out in the ashes and bullets and swords of Europeans. Let us celebrate the town meetings that hung Indios. Let us celebrate the political decisions to exile Indians from Turtle Island. Let us celebrate Columbus's arrival and how all the holy names were changed to accommodate the thick ox tongue of muttering English. Let us celebrate how all the paintings depicting Indios as savages killing and drinking the blood of blonde-haired children. Celebrate the development of banks on hunting grounds and carriages gilded in silk-bearing pompous Englishmen through crisp streets, and women wearing safari jackets setting up their easels beside fishing streams to paint their Georgetown mansions. Celebrate how death was entertainment and how holy relics of feathers and drums and talismans became table decor and circus spectacles. Celebrate chained and guarded houses for open meadows and teepees. Celebrate the beaver gloves and hats, performance stables with horses with braided manes and Indio scalps and skin nailed to the rafters. Celebrate the unspeakable crimes of lawyers drafting laws to rob ancestral lands. Celebrate all their accountants sore-eyed at midnight under reading lamps, tirelessly counting endless stacks of criminal money. Celebrate the landscaped European gardens. God in every bush an Indio pruned. God in every glint of Sterling's dinnerware an Indio polished. God in every sheet an Indio washed. Celebrate the spirit broken, the body abused beyond recognition. Let us, Señor, slip off our tongues to the patronizing bullshit. Let us smile at the pitying glances. Let us celebrate the rape of our women. Let us be devoured by their contempt. Let us saintfully give ourselves to the mob to be burned and hanged. Let us Mexicans wear yokes around our necks for the whites. Let us parade all the imprisoned and drive carts heaped with all the dead birds through Washington. Let us compose elaborate symphonies and marching bands through Virginia's tobacco fields with thousands of slaves. Let us stand at the shores of every ocean and lake and stream and sing the glory of killing and murder beyond comprehension. Come, let us celebrate the churches that accused us of being devils. Celebrate the burning of our sweat lodges and eagle and herbal medicines. Celebrate all the lies and books how we were heathens with no songs or culture. Celebrate the empty mountains and valleys. Celebrate how the once hip-high grass of the plains is now ankle-high crusty scrub owned by millionaire cattlemen. Celebrate that America has not acknowledged the terrible crimes of having done what we accuse it of. Celebrate the pardon of white-collar thieves and murderers on Wall Street or by presidents, not by society, God or me. Celebrate the devastating, willful tragedy, the willfulness of races decrying no racism, the willfulness of torturers decrying no violence, no water torture, the willfulness of supporters of the quincentennial decrying it with all the roses and the blessings. Let us celebrate the frontier adventure of marauding Mexican families taking their homes and celebrate the courageous Daniel Boone trapper purposely betraying and lying. Celebrate the gluttons who triumphed through treachery and murder in broad daylight, destroying all that was different. Celebrate the portrayals of God's chosen people as a people who never even harmed an ant. Celebrate in Santa Fe the pure-blood Spanish romantic idea that they were heroes. Celebrate the madness of historical oppression in San Antonio, with reigning queens and mariachi music and mayoral speeches, celebrating Los Angeles, the agony of millions with confetti and whoopla fanfare and awards to Hispanics, with foundations giving millions to create parades in hundreds of cities. Let us celebrate our own death and oppression. Let us take solemn vows that nothing ever bad happened, that Columbus brought us only enlightenment and baptized us and we became God's children. Let us believe there was no sorrow. Let us commemorate the hate and contempt they brought for us. Let us celebrate the scorn. Let us celebrate their play written in grants and announced in every city, how they loved us, and let us live peacefully in our lands. How act after act and scene after scene depicts them sharing their food and songs with us. How not one of us ever had encountered their vengeance nor lies. How Columbus brought in scene one, flowers and love from Europe. How scene two tells his men humble themselves in our homes and respected us. How scene three shows pure friendship and no hate or fear, portrays how they cared for us and how life was filled with joy. Let us celebrate this with despair in our hearts and blindfolds over our eyes. Celebrate the denial of slaves to the highest bidder. Celebrate how we were leered at and spit at in every town. Celebrate how we starved and how our children became silent. Celebrate our infant mortality rate and alcoholism and drug addiction. Celebrate the despair and the unremitting depression of our people. Celebrate how everyone agrees with everyone. How we grieve and celebrate each sharp sword tip stained with our blood. Celebrate how each pencil and ink quill filled with lies. Celebrate doors closed to us from fear. Celebrate the glassy blue eyes that stare at us. Celebrate each dagger that plunged into trusting brothers and sisters' hearts. Celebrate the false piety and false modesty of investors who thrive on our sadness. Celebrate this long, bloody genocide with bottles of Coors beer and Gallo wines, and quench the thirsty throats of racketeers so they may have strength to fill every American street dancing over our bones. This is a really good book. They both are really. They're great. So go back there. If you want, if you're going to save your money to buy weed, buy the book, and I'll give you a number here in Richmond where you can go pick up a free bag. All right. Is it legal here?
No.
It's not? Wow. Could have fooled me. I thought everybody in the street out there was high. I was like, wow, I should ask that guy if he has it now. Oh, my God. Okay. I'll read you a couple of pieces, that's it, from this new novel. I was told that people wanted me to, they bought A Place to Stand, which is a really great seller worldwide. Next week I'm in China and Japan and Guam and a few other cities. They really liked that book, and then they just came out with a movie coming out in October, but it's in other countries now. But so they said it's about a guy in prison. That book is A Place to Stand. And they said they wanted me to write a successor to it, which is almost impossible because A Place to Stand has taken a life of its own. It's just, you know, it was a book, you know, that I wrote. You never can tell what a book's going to do, but it's gone all over the world in 31 languages, and it's and the people that have come into my life because of it are just amazing, you know, just amazing. So I tried to write a successor to it, and this is the novel. It's one of these books, I'm not really interested in publishing anymore. I just want to keep it, you know, like a child. You know, you hear a lot of the bullshit about, oh yes, my poem was a child that I gave birth to and I sent it out into the world. I was like, fuck that. This child is not going out into the world. This child's staying home till he's 88. I'm going to have the only child living at home till he's 88, you know? Hijito, come here! Because my son on his crutches, yeah, ma, yeah, papa! Give me some bologna! Okay, chapter one. I know this tale of penance and redemption is steeped in the romantic road marks of a modern-day Siddhartha setting out on the hero's journey, and it may seem that way on the surface. 5 years old, brother and I plucked from bedded grandmas and driven through canyons to arrive at an orphanage, and driven to three figures in dark robes on a rain-swept night, who escort us inside the three-story red brick building upstairs to a third floor and into a creaking dorm, and appoint us a cot. In a way, yes, so begins this modest tale of mine as an American orphan. In a fashion Twain, Dickens, or Dostoevsky would cherish, in a decaying dorm with dozens of kids in bunks separated by hanging sheets soaked wet from the rain coming through ceiling cracks, I wept. I want mama, mama, I want my mama. And Camilo, my older brother, appearing before me in a flash of lightning, struck me across the face, warning, Orlando, don't cry, they'll beat you up, don't cry. Ah, well, 30 years later, having finished my prison term, I think, hey, dear brother, I don't cry anymore. Despite my unwillingness to get along with the administration, doing day for day at 29 August of 78, I was released from Youngsville in Colorado, completing 6 years for selling heroin. On the way out, my spirit lofted in awe of the night morning. I dropped off my box of notebooks and letters to go to my sisters and picked up my airline ticket to New Mexico and $100. As much as I would like to imbue my imprisonment with a cavalier claim that it was filled with adventure, it was anything but. Unlike the fools in those fucking prison movies who glamorize it, truth was I was a stupid 22-year-old when I got busted. 8 cents in my pocket and a court-appointed lawyer. Fuck the adventure. For years, I glimpsed a bit of the morning moon between the guard towers and used my imagination to write poems about a moon without razor wire across its surface. For years, I peered at the sunrise through a scratch in the painted window, and for almost a decade, while my mind roamed outside the walls, my body paced a 9x12 world. I didn't know what to expect passing through the big gates into the dark heart of freedom. But the moment my foot fell on freedom ground, I had trouble walking. My legs got shaky, my gut nervous. Freedom was large. Standing outside, the moon dwarfed me to a speck and took my breath away. I couldn't believe it. Presented with a view of the world without bars, walls, and razor wire, the state unclenched its chokehold and I inhaled clean morning air, and I was weightless, and I ceased to exist, an insignificant soul. I found myself drifting in so much free will, it scared the hell out of me. I had the sensation I was falling and felt like I had just landed on a new planet with no gravity. In prison, I knew who I was, but out here, I was no one, a stranger in the dawn staring at the stars. Well, one small step for criminal kind, one giant step for Orlando Lucero. Ambling as awkward as an astronaut in space, the immensity of the sky and earth made it almost impossible to get my bearing and forced me just to stop for a second and get my balance. So much space. I felt myself floating in an aimless pause, as if my life had ceased and abandoned me in a stillness between the end of a sentence and the beginning of freedom. And I didn't have the words to name this independence. I knew if I couldn't find them, I'd be lost as a wandering soul in Dante's wasteland, a grim smoke trail willowing off the felon's flesh and heap, bone heap, dissipating into nothing but the tortured moans for a return to prison. But no rash decisions, I thought. Definitely no more dealing. I was different, moving lightly, looking at life from a whole different perspective. I smiled at the dirt, the weeds and stones as if they shared my joy. It could have been the golden sunrise or maybe the silence over the high desert prairie, but I was feeling nostalgic and philosophical, and for a moment I wondered about my past, my present, my future, the dozens of love letters I had written over the last year to Lila, vowing my eternal love. I finished my time, yet the sadness of leaving so many friends behind clothed my skin like a fever. But between the gate and the van, my life was uprooted from the granite ruins and the criminal paperwork that condemned me, scattered across the warden's lawn, and a new narrative of life began. I mentally noted a goodbye prayer for those left behind, and a help me, Lord prayer as I stepped toward the white van idling in the employee parking lot. And as we drove away, with a certain reluctance, I glanced at the prison that seemed to have a strange force drawing me back, but I was determined I wasn't coming back. And as the guard locked the van doors and shifted into gear and we turned down the road, my skin seemed to fit better. That massive spaceship of iron and concrete, that hulking empire of the doomed, sailed away into the dark horizon without me, collecting debris of more broken lives. And I told myself loud and louder, I'll tell you, that the morning moon shone on me and murmured her affirmation that day, whispering, you, O soul shifter, have endured the dreamer's ritual and become spirit man. Moments like this cry out for an epiphany, a climax. Like in those Ben-Hur and Moses movies I watched as a child. Mountains split, chariots splinter, prophets wield a staff and command legions swooping down on the desert heathens. But no, in a time of epidemic mediocrity, pervasive corruption and endless wars, if a cello player were to appear and strum the sweetest dirge, he'd be arrested for trespassing and playing without a permit. Nothing but the exhaust pipe sputtering, Waylon Jennings on the radio, and a dumbass guard smoking discount res cigs, and three other convicts threatening to kill each other. One black, one white, one Chicano. Outlaws in a B-roll spaghetti western, the four gutter grunges, I thought. I smiled with irony at my reflection in the window. No medieval knights were we on a romantic quest. We were criminalized killers, thieves, drug addicts, seething to avenge our maimed hearts on anyone unlucky enough to be present when we blew. It was business as usual, happening 1,000 times over America every single morning, and American citizens didn't even care. Every single morning with men like us who had been broken into resentful brutes, who'd waited a long time for the hour to fall to purge our rage on society for the unjust torture. And these three, having lived in cells next to each other for decades with nothing to do, fantasized extreme ways to kill each other because of their race. Ah, well. Sometimes that nasty joker in the deck shows up when one is holding the best of hands, is it like this when we have our freedom, creating this laughable situation, possessing them with the chilling images of how they dismembered the two once we arrived at the terminal. It could have been 3 minutes or 30, I don't know. I was mesmerized by the reflection of my face on the glass, first time I'd ever seen it, skimming over the flat roof shacks, scrub brush and sage until we finally glided under the corrugated airport terminal. All right, here's where Daddy leaves his bitches. The guard growled and swung to the curb and pulled out as quickly, leaving us stranded like four ducks at a busy intersection. We stood saying nothing, in the habit of being told what to do, just standing there until the Chicano said, need a drink before I kill you fuck faces. Skinhead followed in the black behind him, and I took up the rear thinking, when water rises to the chin, you gotta find a straw. And that straw was an end stool at the bar where I sat in case some crazy shit broke out. I ordered water. Skinhead snarled, motherfucker, and ordered Jack and Coke. And the Chicano, tequila, the black, vodka. They stared in the mirror and the Chicano said, we're next to each other 20-some years in that dungeon and we're released at the same time. Motherfucker. He downed his drink and shot two fingers at the bartender, double. Cruel and unusual punishment. Skinhead licked his lips, hear, hear, to the one who filed a class action suit. He drained his glass and slid it toward the bartender. Deuce it up. It'd be how we did, the black brother gazed in the mirror, pleased with the vodka. He raised his glass, I'll take it how they give it, in seconds, minutes, hours, days, or years, all the freedom they want to give, just bring it on. But why'd you want to kill each other? Was it the gang thing, I asked? It was always the gang thing. Are you posing as a fucking counselor now? the brother stated. No, I just ask only because we ain't inside anymore. And after an uncomfortable silence set in, I added, if I was your counselor, and God knows y'all need one, I'd be making mad money with you motherfuckers. I had a million reasons to gut cheese, and I hear I can't scratch up nary a one skinhead offered. Toast! I raised my glass of water to a killing averted. Wouldn't speak so soon, the Chicano grinned. Hey, hey, the other two chimed. They ordered more drinks and stared at the mirror, wondering, measuring the incalculable damage years in prison had inflicted on them. Not wanting to notice what could have been and never was, they ordered more drinks. They were buzzed and I said goodbye, and they wrote their address on napkins, a pool hall, a bar, and a laundromat in Portland. The temperature on my skin went up again. I'd miss them. Feeling bad for us, I went up the escalator and headed for my gate. I was in the same sorry condition. No home or address, but I was heading to New Mexico to jumpstart my life. There's the first one. You can buy it when it comes out, if it ever comes out. I may just keep it. I mean, I'm really beginning to like that feeling of keeping the book, throwing it in a box in the closet or something. And I'm not saying that heroically, because there's nothing heroic about it. It's just something I want to do, you know? Now, we're going to take about 5 to 10 minutes here to ask some questions and answers. All right? And I believe y'all, how many of students, raise your hand? Well, good. You're going to ask some good questions then. You're not going to be scared and squeamish to try to fit in, I hope. You're going to, like, break the mold here. Okay, who's first?
Yes. Okay, I heard earlier that you punched the rich from jail to talk to someone in the immigrants. Can you tell us about how that experience was?
Yeah, good question. Good question. Every time I go, I'm invited someplace, I always make it a point to go to the nearest prison. Yeah. And I belong to a legacy of writers and poets that, contrary to all the pop culture bullshit that goes on, I belong to a legacy of poets and writers that do not believe in feeding the media crap, you know? That's online or otherwise, right? I believe in doing the work and having enough time for my family. And I've got 5 great kids, a filmmaker, a dancer, and some amazing people in my life, great places. I go all over the world, it's wonderful. But I do not stop to take an interview with People Magazine about the color of my frickin' jockstrap. You know, I'm not gonna play that game where you guys get on your, I was on Hollywood doing movies and stuff. And I made one huge blockbuster. How many have you seen Blood and Blood Out? Oh, yeah. That's one of the movies I made. And every magazine in the world was, they wanted me to be on it. And it's still today the second best selling video in the world. And it was done 12 years ago. It's become a cult film. I never even guessed it. I never even thought, right? But I dig it. Keep buying it because it pays my bills. But, you know, I realized the hard way as I went, I won the National Book Award, the American Book Award, and I was like winning everything. I could take a shit and I'd win for that, you know? I was winning everything. And I just got, you get tired of freaking winning, you know? It just becomes a big freaking joke. There's this whole system set up where they've got to have a winner. You know? And whatever happened to the guy that went out to repair his roof? I wanted to be the guy repairing his roof, not some guy sitting in New York, you know, talking to Look Magazine. I wanted to be the guy sitting with his daughter on the couch reading a story, not in Los Angeles talking to a studio executive from Universal. Just crap, you know? All right, you want to buy it? Bring your checkbook. End of story. I don't have to go take meetings, you know? I mean, it's like ridiculous. I mean, wow. I think of some of the crazy shit I did. It just makes me laugh now, you know, in order to avoid all of that. But I belong to that group of people, the poets that are great poets that you never hear about. I love those poets. The poets that you hear about every day are like, oh, please, you know, like wet toilet paper, very hard to pull apart the truth, you know, it's like, without tearing it, you know. It's just terrible. I mean, or, you know, the constant glorification of who's the greatest, you know. I just love the work. I love working on the land. I have an organic farm. I love working with my kids, you know. I'm taking my, I told the people in Asia, yeah, I've got an assistant. You got to pay for my assistant. I can't be carrying all this stuff. So, you know, when I sent the passport picture, they said, well, this is a 12-year-old kid. That's my assistant, I said. You know, that's my son. If I'm going to go to Europe or Asia or something, I'm not going to take some. Come on. Does anybody want to go to Europe? Nah, we're busy, Poppy. Well, how about you, Lucy? I'll go. Okay, let's go. You know, it's like that, you know? It's such a joy to see her eyes, like, feast on the landscape of new language and culture, you know? Who in the hell wants to... That interrupted with a phone call from the New York Times. Or who was it, like this novel, somebody got a couple of chapters from the New York Times and called it a masterpiece. Who gives a shit? I want to know whether the farmer next door that I wrote this about calls it anything. Yeah. That's it. And you know what? This book here, I wrote a poem. And the guy came over to my house on his horse. And he said, no, Santiago, cabrón, you got it wrong, hombre. I don't smoke cigarettes, somebody. Why did you put that in there? I'm like, what the hell? You're going to change the whole damn poem because you don't smoke a cigarette? Well, that's not the truth. What the truth? So I had to call the publisher and say, you got to change the damn line. You got to smoke a cigarette. I love that, you know? Oh, you know, this is great and stuff. It's just ridiculous, you know? So, okay, enough of that bullshit. Now, ask questions, because when you don't ask questions... You are betraying with contempt the bodies buried in this dirt from the Union Confederacy Wars. Now, raise your hands. You've got a lot of people here that gave their life for you to be able to sit in this room. Go.
If you had to choose one piece that you think kind of captures the self-awakening that happened when you first began to really learn to write, what piece would you say that was?
The bookstore guy, do you have Immigrants in Our Own Land? Get that book. That was the one written in prison. That was the one that just, poetry just blew me away in that book. I wrote that in a prison cell. There's poems in that book. It's in its 29th printing or something. There's poems in that book written in the cell when I thought I was going to die the next day in a gang war. And I swear to God, I was not going to be alive. So I wrote poems thinking I was going to die. Isn't that great? How many of you can write anything thinking you're going to die? Oh, guess what? I want you to go ahead and write a poem for tomorrow's class because tomorrow night you're dead. I bet you every one of you would be on your desk going, this has got to be real, man. This has got to tell it all, man. I got to tell it all. All right, Mom, you don't understand, but I got to be honest with you now. I love Lucy. Or whatever, you know? When you get that kind of immediate urgency in your life, you write stuff. And it's really cool. There's one poem in there that is so famous, it's not even funny. It's been anthologized in every country in the world. And when I wrote it thinking it was just a little tiny homage to my grandmother saying, I love you. And that poem has brought me so much money. That one poem paid for a brand new horse, a tractor, and fencing. I was working, you know, it's so cool, you know, it's like whatever happened to your reason for working because you felt love in your heart. Think of that for one second, besides the stupid check and your stupid careers and all this other bullshit, how many of you have worked because it feels like there's so much love in your heart for what you do? I was working with a guy from Burma who had his house burned out and his family murdered. And we were in this dig, these big trenches and stuff. And these guys, these big, big guys that had working for me, they worked like 5 minutes and they were like, they were filmmakers. And they were like, oh, I can't do it anymore. And I was in this trench picking up big boulders, man, and throwing them, you know, boom, all day. I was sore as hell. And Sapo, the guy from Burma, at nighttime he would give me these amazing, he lived in a refugee camp for 50 years, and he learned how to give these amazing massages where the pain would just leave you, right? And one of the guys was in the cabin and said, how can you work like that all day, you know? I mean, how can you do that, Jimmy? You're like 55 years old. And I looked up and I said, every boulder is a poem I wrote, man. And when you have that kind of love in your heart, you can pick them up all day. that trench and these boulders was possible because of the poetry that I sold to the world. So yeah, bam, boom, there's a joy, there's a love of living. How many of you have that? As young as you are, ask yourself that question tonight. And if you don't answer it correctly, then get the hell out and go find your love of life. Go find it. Go find it. There's an amazing revolution waiting for you to join it out there in the food industry, in the energy industry, in the green movement, in the prison reform, in the injustice reform. There's like all these things waiting for you. Why would any sane child be here? Dude, this is like the birth of war place here. This is where people warred. They warred for freedom. And how many of you can honestly say you're free? Think about the contradictions. Oh, God, don't start crying on me. See, there's two people crying back there? Don't do that. I'm kidding you. Don't be look. See that? Don't believe everything you hear. Come on. Oh, what's the habit when somebody walks in the door? You all know who's in your class, but everybody's got to. When somebody walks in, everybody's got to turn. When you know, it's just another student in the class. I was wondering about that, you know? Haven't you? About the dumb things we do? So, another question. Go ahead. Yeah.
Been speaking about legacy in the South, and I was wondering what your opinion was of the monuments to the Confederates that you've seen around the city.
You know, I can be against slavery and I can be against everything, you know. And monuments, you know, I don't like injuring or offending people. So if a monument's going to offend somebody, any segment of the population, it shouldn't be there. But if it represents what these crazy, crazy guys in the Confederate, I mean, they all died in the hundreds of thousands. And you got to give it up to them, you know? I mean, how many of us would charge a hill and know we're going to die in 2 minutes? That's good. That's what I call, in Spanish, ese vato tiene un huevo totes. He's got big balls. How many of you? No, I don't think Americans even have balls anymore, do we? We've had... Last time I checked, mine was the size of BBs. I was like, what happened to my... You know? But yeah, dude, these guys, they gave everything they had, and you gotta just... It's like a boxer who gets the shit beat out of him in the 15th round. He's not even recognizable anymore, but you gotta give it to him. He's got heart. He's got heart, man. The guy almost, he gave his whole life to win this, man. Look at him. You know, and I feel the same way about the Confederate and the Union. But if you're gonna injure somebody, like... It's terrible to injure people. It's terrible. When you use public money, you can't use my taxes to disrespect Mexicans. I pay about $200,000 a year. You can't use that to build bombs to kill Iraqis, mostly women. You can't do that. But they do it. They scoff at me and kick me in the face and say, stop us. So you see the powers have gotten way out of balance. And when powers get way out of balance like that, then we've lost control of whatever stays in the park or goes or stays, you know? Why don't you, there's so many other things you can put in the park. Like, how about we put statues all over the city of Richmond of poets? That wouldn't offend anybody. Or naked women. No, I'm kidding. Like, all over Paris and Mexico, they get all these women. In Mexico, when you do a poetry reading, mi amor, gente del alma. They hand out tequila before you give a read. Everybody in the room gets tequila. You're like, orale. By the time you get up to read, you're like, hey, what's up? Everybody's like, I love you. You don't even have to read, and they love your work. And they're like, oh, and I want to buy your books. Okay, let's go. You don't even have to read, and I'll buy your books, right? So, yeah, no, you don't have to. There's so much offensive stuff against people of color. It's horrible. It's just, and it's not our job to teach the white people. It's your job to teach you. You know what I'm saying? And there's nothing wrong when we talk about you. There's nothing wrong with you. It was like, we hate you. It's just like you're the dumb kid in the class. You got to catch up. You know, it's not nice to be mean to kids. Don't be mean to us. Be nice to us. We'll be nice to you. It's okay. Everything's fine. But you don't walk into a classroom right away and say, I get the radiator in the winter. What do you mean you get the radiator in the winter? All the class gets the radiator in the winter. We're all cold. And it's my radiator. I mean, I really do encounter people like that on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. In my world, when I have to talk to executives in Hollywood, it's like, it's all mine. Everything's mine. And I'm just like, wow, I don't want to be here. And I leave. I don't want to be in this room, and I leave. I don't have to be in that room. So, yes, if I'm walking with a if I'm walking with a child down one of your streets, and I walk into a bar, a restaurant, or something, and Lou Dobbs or all those other array of total idiots get on TV, and they say, ah, those Mexicans are rapists and they're drug dealers. Wow. And I look at my little boy, and he looks at the TV, and he starts to cry, and I say, what's wrong? He says, well, how come they're talking bad about us, Papi? Wow, you just messed up a little tiny soul. Why haven't you stopped that? I don't do that to you. I don't put on newscasts and write articles about how hateful the white people are and how every single school shooting has been done by a white person. I don't do that. I don't do that. I don't do that. There's decency. You don't blanket a whole race of saying, all these horrible massacres have been done by white people. Oh yeah, you have a black guy who shoots another black guy over crack. That's not like walking in a Sandy Hook and killing 30 kids. But you don't see us running with our editorials to blame you. But you do it to us at the airports, at the restaurants, in the newspapers. You do it and you do it and you do it. So I have to constantly protect my kids and explain to them, no, you're not taking anybody's job away. And you're, well, Bobby, they were saying that I did. No, you're not taking people's jobs away. Well, by the way, if you want to take Obama's, get it. You know, do you see what I'm saying? There's got to be, if you're going to be here being educated, then get the education. And don't just duck step in line. Don't do it. Don't do it to your life. Just don't. Go out and smoke a bowl or something. I'm kidding, all right? We joke a lot. She's like, no, you're not. Two more questions, then I'll sign books. And really, I don't want to just sell the books. There's this thing called empathy, which you lose with the internet. And that's, think of what the guy did. First of all, the books had to be ordered. They came into a really big box, and you know it wasn't some wealthy Wall Street broker who brought them in. Some poor student picked up the box. He was tired. She had to go study. Brought them in. Set up the books, came early, probably had a lot of studying to do, got them really pretty on the table, did all of that, and just did all that stuff for us just to walk by. No, stop. Hey, what's this? Yeah. Okay, I'll buy that. You know? Okay, two more questions. That's it. Yes?
Between the time when you first left the jail and you were kind of feeling insignificant to the moment to now, where you're obviously successful and internationally known poet, was there a point in your life where you could recognize, like, wow, like, I did it? Like, I found a way to push myself? And what was that drive?
I like that. I like that a lot, that your language about I found a way to push myself. That's a good thing you just said. I don't know how to explain that. I like that, though. I found a way to push myself because I'm always looking for ways that make my life meaningful. And that's ways to push myself. See, I do a lot of fishing and hunting. I used to play a lot of basketball. We go jet skiing on this lake that we have a ranch by. And I don't think I ever get better at fishing. It's just a reason to push myself. I want to get out there because I get off on seeing that trout hit the line and jump up off in the water. I get off on that. I mean, such a beautiful sight. Well, like, I like to go. I went hiking the other day, and I caught a bear eating a baby mountain lion. How many people have seen that? Or I went hiking one day and came upon an eagle tree, which are rare, and it's where all the eagles come to shed feathers. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't understand. I was walking up this ravine with all these waterfalls and stuff, and the ground started turning white, and I didn't even recognize it. I was like, I don't know where my head was at, but the ground was all white. And I thought, well, why is it white? And I looked up, and the whole tree was white. It was a white tree. And it was eagle shit. And then I looked down, and I saw one feather. And it's weird how the eyes work. Because I only saw one feather. And then I saw 20,000 feathers. And guess what I did? I left some there. You know, because you can sell eagle feathers for about 300 a feather, 400 a feather, right? So I took about 200. I took them back to the cabin. I blessed them on my altar, and then I took them to the sun dancers and gave one to each warrior and said that when you go into your vision quest, pray for me. Wow. Those, I mean, they go into that world where you're going to go when you die. They're there when they're dancing, you know? And they can literally talk to God. So he said, one had a feather, and I said, this is for a prayer. And my children are incredibly successful and happy. No one's ever been sick. It works. It all comes out, you know? Those are eagle feathers. Right? Okay. Is somebody over here?
If you would find literature the way you did in prison, if you weren't in prison, like if you didn't have that experience,
do you think so.
You would come to that?
I don't think so. It's just kind of a hard thing to predict what would have happened had I not gone to prison. I don't know what I would have done. I don't really. That's a hard thing to predict, you know? I don't know. I do know that I started writing. Because in every great book that I read by an American, American writers cursed with the worst curses against my family. Mm-hmm. I mean, for instance, Hemingway, mm-hmm. he would never allow Mexicans to think in his novels. Mm-hmm. That was such an insult to me. That would be like going to your mother and saying, I want to sell your daughter. Mm-hmm. I mean, how could American writers do that to us? Say that we don't think. As a people. Wow, how could writers do that? That's like me cussing everywhere in front of your face. No matter, every book, I mean, even Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman with his Manifest Destiny said that they had, here goes, this God-given right to attack Mexico and steal all the land. We should, because it was according to Manifest Destiny. How are you going to argue with God? Wow. And I went to the Camden Cemetery and I took an eagle feather to Walt Whitman and I laid it on his grave and I said, dude, you almost got my ass killed with your kill all the Mexicans bullshit, you know? When we were here 5,000 years. You want to count that? 5,000 years before you came? And then all you do is show up and start cussing me? Because I didn't bring in the eggs from the chicken coop or something, I mean, we know the history is ironic, and we know that it's being written in a way that is closer to the truth and stuff, but you call it, what do you call it? Re-what? When history's what? You know, it's re-something. It's a...
Revision.
There's a big moment, called Revision, where you're going to revise it. Okay, let's not revise history. Let's just say you love all Indians and all Mexicans. Well, it's going to leave it like that. Right? It's just insane. I mean, it's insane that you're taking away what the very fabric of culture. You're taking away what makes us human, our memories. You're saying that we're all psycho. You're saying that 7 million Americans are psychotic. We're not. We have memories that have been passed down to us, you know? Isn't that weird? And you come up with something that says, no, we want you to believe in lies. It's really hard. You know? Like, prison rehabilitates. When was the last time you really saw a prisoner rehabilitated? Come on. It is the number one place. You want to become a hacker? You want to learn how to break into houses? You want to learn how to do horrible things to people? That's where you go. And we got them lining up all the way down the block and around the corner. Because someone's making money. We don't live in a socialist economy. We're living in a capitalist society. If it doesn't make money, it ain't here. So every single thing in this society has to make money. Everything. It's really simple. There's got to be a profit margin for putting people in prison or they wouldn't be there. And there's vast profit margins. Do you realize that my stockbrokers, they kept coming back to me through my accountant saying, you have to invest in prisons. You have to invest in prisons. We will triple your money in 3 months. It's not a big deal. Everybody does it. I didn't, but everybody does it. The guy was telling me, just invest in the silverware. And you'll always make money. It's like having the golden goose, you know? Or like the pharmaceuticals. If you watch enough commercials, I guarantee you're going to be on pharmaceuticals. But that, Dalada's are not heroin. They won't get you hooked. Whew. Okay. Listen, I don't want to bring the... this was a really cool... I had a great night. I had a great day in prison. I had a great reading today. I just want... When I come, I'm not going to be here probably forever. So I just wanted to impart to you what makes my life meaningful, and that's being socially engaged, conscientiously challenged. I want to challenge the people that are trying to trick you with smoke screens. That's my job. And I want you to be there too. I mean, I firmly and totally and absolutely believe that you are 100 times more smart than I could ever be. But you got to act on your smartness. Otherwise, it becomes useless. And you know what they said? Whoever said that? A brain is a terrible thing to waste, and then they threw an egg in a frying pan. Well, I happen to disagree. I like drugs. No, I'm kidding you. I think it did wonderful things. I mean, I had like huevo rancheros, egg omelets, and green chili. I could go on. No. I could give you a whole menu of how to scramble that egg, baby. Anyway, what I'm saying is your knowledge, what you learn, it's your obligation to challenge the powers that be. And if you just go along with them, oh, don't waste your life or your education on that, you know? All right, I'll sign books. Thanks so much. You're the best.